From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. After two consecutive winters with above-average snowpacks across much of the West, a lot of people who had been quite nervous about water supplies are feeling, well, at least a little bit better right now. Many reservoirs across California are full or expected to be full soon. Snowpacks have consistently been above average in much of the West. Stream flows in many rivers have been at years-long highs. And whereas about 90% of the U.S. West was in a state of drought just a few years ago, the U.S. Drought Monitor estimates that right now only about a quarter of the West is experiencing drier than usual conditions. But most of that is based on water we can see. That's the water that falls from the sky, the water that freezes in our mountains, the water that accumulates in lakes and reservoirs. But that's just part of a much bigger picture, because a lot of the water that we rely on is stored beneath the surface. For obvious reasons, groundwater has historically been much harder to estimate than lake elevations or snowpack. Some modern tools and technologies are making that a little bit easier, but there are still a lot of mysteries about water levels in the places we can't easily see. And one of those mysteries is recharge. That's the rate at which underground aquifers fill and the extent to which they fill as a result of what happens on the surface. And in a new study published in Nature Climate Change, the hydrologist Scott Allen and his collaborators reported that groundwater recharge in many places in the world will be vastly affected by global warming in ways we are only just beginning to understand. Scott Allen is an assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Science at the University of Nevada at Reno, where he studies the water cycle, particularly as it pertains to how water impacts and is impacted by different ecosystems. Scott Allen, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here today.
It's a pleasure to have you today. How is the water in Nevada right now?
You know, we're above average, and it didn't look like it was going to be that way a couple months ago, but the spring has been, well, the winter was warm and dry, but the spring has been a little bit cool and wet here, so things are looking pretty good, at least on the snowpack, which is, well, it's maybe the most apparent way that we keep track of the climatic water status.
Yeah, but there are all these other ways. Scott, our program has this delightfully nerdy audience, but I still occasionally worry that the things I find fascinating and exciting aren't going to translate well. And, you know, on its face, this other thing that we're going to be talking about today, the water underground, groundwater, might not be the most tantalizing topic in the world. But I'm not sure I can adequately express how important it is. So I thought maybe today we could start, if you could help me, like, make the case for why groundwater is actually this super sexy thing.
Yeah, I'm usually the person to bring things towards more nerdiness, deeper into that direction, but I'll do my best. So you mentioned drought, and as you said, the drought that affects our subsurface aquifers and those reservoirs is much harder to keep track of. And the challenge is that it also varies at much longer timescales. So that means it could be refilling over year to year to year, and then we could be extracting and using that water from year to year. And that also means ecosystems, that also means the atmosphere taking up that water. And so that's both a blessing and a curse. By having this very slow-changing large body of water available, it means that it can hold things over in dry years. We are using water resources that are in aquifers underground that are recharged and filled from precipitation that potentially fell decades, centuries, or millennia ago. And so it allows for this buffering and smoothing of interannual precipitation variability, which we as a society need for our water resources. We aren't, you know, our society isn't ready to increase and cut our water use with respect to the 100%, 200% variation in precipitation that can occur from year to year.
And the reason why this is, you know, groundwater is slow changing has a lot to do with just water flow, right? Like water flows on the surface are measured in meters per second. But underground, water flow is often measured in like feet per day. Just water moves just very, very slowly underground. And that's why, as you say, you know, the water that we pull up from the ground, or the water that eventually comes out of the groundwater into, you know, whatever the lowest basin is many years often, many decades, maybe centuries or even older.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you a little experiment that a collaborator did to contextualize this. He took a chunk of, like, just a shovel full of clay. Okay, you know, any clay that you might dig up from out in a floodplain, river, or something like that, put it in a bucket full of dyed water, let it sit there for 6 months, and then cut it open, and that dye had only diffused a couple of centimeters inward into that chunk of clay. So it's very, very, very slow, potentially, in the subsurface, which then also means that if we do deplete those groundwater resources, they can be slow to recharge as well.
One of the reasons why this is important is because what we're talking about here is fresh water. That's the water that, you know, most of the water that we use as human beings. If you ask people to picture fresh water, they're really likely to imagine like a lake or a reservoir or a river. They might think about snowpacks. They might even think about all the water that's circulating in our atmosphere at any given time. But all of that's really quite a blip compared to what's stored underground.
You know, you see different numbers on this, and they're always changing. But in terms of the amount of fresh water on the globe, I believe the number is 99% of it is held in either groundwater or glaciers. And then the other 1% are those surface water flowing streams or lakes that we see.
So like the comparison there is like if you've got a gallon water jug and you take one sip of it, that's the fresh water that we see. And then the rest of it's all stored up.
Right. And keep in mind that that glacial and ice cap water, much of that is in polar regions where it's not feasible to be used by people in any time soon, or is just going to melt into the ocean and become not fresh water anymore. So the groundwater is really the major water resource that society relies on.
Now, to the extent that most people do think about groundwater, they probably think about it in terms of extraction. That's one way that groundwater is depleted. We build wells, we pull the water up from the ground, we use it for our needs up here in the surface. But there are also these natural ebbs and flows that are simply a matter of how much precipitation falls on the surface, makes it into the aquifers, and then how fast gravity transports that water somewhere else. And when storage down there gets low and then a big precipitation event comes along, that's pretty much recharge, right? At a very simple level.
At a very simple level, yes.
But it is more complicated than that, because while it seems like it would be easy to estimate, you know, whatever you just like, whatever falls from the sky minus whatever eventually runs off into the rivers and lakes, and there you go, you got groundwater. But there are these two other very important factors. There's evaporation and transpiration. Can you talk a little bit about how big of an effect these have on how much water actually ends up stored deep in the ground?
Well, this number usually surprises people, but of the water, of the precipitation, so both rain and snow that fall on land across the globe, about 70% of that is returned to the atmosphere by evaporation and transpiration. So evaporation, that's either evaporation from soils or directly from plant surfaces, soil surfaces, or lakes and streams, and plant water use. And plant water use is the much larger term between evaporation and transpiration.
So actually, so more water ends up in the atmosphere as a result of coming in through the roots of plants and then evaporating out of the leaves of plants than just gets evaporated off of the surface of the soil or surface of standing bodies of water.
So that number that's used by plants also exceeds the amount of water that will percolate down into the soils and recharge groundwater to eventually become stream water.
So those damn plants are taking all our water.
Yeah, but, you know, they do a lot of good, too. So, it's a compromise, and I think we're better with them on the landscape.
We'd be gone pretty fast without them.
I think so. You know, you'd have just such massive erosion, too, without them, that your water quality would degrade immediately.
So when we put these two ideas together, the evaporation, the transpiration, we get evapotranspiration, and that it probably won't surprise anyone to know that the rates of evapotranspiration can vary greatly depending on regional ecologies and climate patterns. You know, evapotranspiration happens different in the desert than it does in a rainforest. And your research looks at how this ratio of changes in evapotranspiration to changes in precipitation will affect the overall budget of water underground.
Right. Evapotranspiration that occurs is a function of both the atmospheric demand for that water and the supply. For example, if you're in a dry desert region, there's a lot of demand because there's a lot of solar radiation coming in. There's dry air, so the air could hold and take up a lot more water, but there's not that much water available for evaporation. And thus, you can have a very high potential evapotranspiration, but not that high actual evapotranspiration. And so what we found was that this aridity, so this ratio of the dryness relative to how much the potential evapotranspiration to the precipitation, is an estimator of the groundwater recharge. And so the question that leads us to is, well, what happens if that relative amount of precipitation changes in the future? And what happens if that relative amount of evapotranspiration changes in the future?
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of think about this maybe in an oversimplified way as like a grid, right? There are four potential changes. You could have an area where you have less precipitation and more evapotranspiration. That's going to lead to less groundwater. There would be areas where there would be more precipitation and less evaporation. That would be presumably more groundwater. And then there would be these areas where both of these variables are moving in the same direction under climate change. And the extent of those increases or decreases would impact how much water is underground. So presumably, it's the areas where groundwater recharge decreases as a result of precipitation and evapotranspiration that we're most concerned about. You looked at thousands of spots around the globe. Can you give me a few other examples of places in the world where we might find this particular balance?
The areas in which we will likely see the biggest decreases in recharge are, for example, in the central Great Plains and upper Midwest for the U.S., as well as the southwest, deep southwest, so south of southern Arizona and Mexico. Some other areas would be Southern Europe. Southern Europe appears to, based on our calculations, seems to be quite sensitive and likely to have reduced recharge in the future. And Eastern Europe as well has a high probability of decreased recharge.
And so these are the places that presumably we want to take a hard look at. And if there are places in the world where we would want to start really thinking hard about how we're using water, how we're pulling it out of the ground, how much we're relying on it in these long-term projections for fulfilling the needs of our society, those are going to be sort of the hot spots.
Yeah, I do think so. But I also think it's worth saying that there's quite a lot of uncertainty in these forward predictions. And because our analysis shows the sensitivity of groundwater recharge exceeds the changes in precipitation, it creates this outsize effect that we're predicting. And so we pulled into this study existing climate scenario predictions. And because we found this interesting pattern where, for example, on average, the change in groundwater recharge is 2.2 times larger than the change in precipitation itself. So for example, a 1% increase in precipitation leads to a 2.2% increase in recharge. And so these estimates of groundwater recharge are ultimately very sensitive to estimates of future climate, which remains an area of uncertainty. It remains an area of a lot of work and a lot of effort, but you know, it's still a prediction 50 years into the future.
Yeah, and look, one of the things that can happen that probably a lot of people don't think too much about right now is that under climate warming, we presumably have more evaporation. More evaporation means more moisture in the air. More moisture in the air means in some places in the world, more precipitation, certainly changing precipitation patterns. And so this mucks up the estimates, right? I mean, like, there's so much stochastic variability here that this is really just the beginning of the process of better understanding what we're going to see decades and decades into the future in terms of groundwater.
And like, hitting the nail on the head, right? If there's more potential for evapotranspiration in the future, well, that also means that there's more moisture entering the atmosphere, which means that there might be more possibility of precipitation. In some regions of the world, warmer air means that air masses coming from the ocean can hold more water, and that means more precipitation falling over land. In other areas, warmer air means that those clouds aren't cooling to the point where droplets start to form and start to fall out, and so those areas get less precipitation. So whereas the map of predicted temperature increases across the globe are fairly consistent expectations of warming in most places, that is not the case for precipitation projections. They are widely variable, even at fairly small scales within regions. For example, there's parts within the Rocky Mountains where substantial increases in precipitation are expected, which means substantial increases in groundwater recharge. And then there's other areas where decreases are expected, which is ultimately going to mean decreases in recharge.
With all of these uncertainties in mind, are there places where you saw potential precipitation increases that were substantially greater than the changes in evapotranspiration, such that, you know, these are areas where it is more likely we'll end up with even more groundwater?
Yeah. So our model predicts that for much of the Great Basin and for much of the northwestern U.S. And that's partly because these are areas that have fairly cold winters and probably will have more precipitation entering. And these are also areas where the movement in this spectrum of aridity, moving to the less and less arid, means larger fractions of the precipitation will become groundwater recharge as well. That effect could be even more outsized if you go, for example, into the mountains a bit, where, let's say in the Great Basin, mountainous regions are responsible for much of the groundwater that shows up in streams and in the valleys. And those are less arid climates, and thus they're going to be even more sensitive to increases in precipitation with respect to increased recharge. So that's potentially a good thing.
I wanted to take a step back and ask you about a paper you contributed to last year. This was an essay in the journal Bioscience about the inspiration that scientists might have, the observations we might be privy to, even the insights we might derive if we all just spent a little bit more time standing out in the rain. I love this, by the way, because scientists don't usually write this way, first of all. Second of all, 20 scientists, there are 20 authors on this paper, 20 scientists working together don't usually write this way. Talk about how that paper came about and how you became involved in it.
Oh, that's funny. So the lead author, John Van Stan, is one of my favorite collaborators. And him and I believe this started as a conversation between the two of us over coffee at a conference several years ago. And pushing back and forth over to what degree is it really a problem that we just put sensors out or look at the after effects of phenomena as opposed to actually observing them directly? I'm the more conservative one, and so we push back and forth on that, on how it is, and that's ended up turning into this narrative that we then realize this is just two people's opinions. So let's get some more people involved and flesh out some of these ideas, because it is ultimately an opinion piece. And I feel like an article that reflects the opinions of many is often more useful than the opinions of two eccentric people.
The opinion that all of these authors seemed to coalesce around was that scientists would do themselves well to take a step back from these assumptions about how water works and really reconnect themselves with the real basic fundamentals of what happens when, you know, water falls on the ground and turns into this little ephemeral puddle or hits your hand and rolls to one side or another.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a good anecdote for you. So there's a watershed for Portland that had a lot of old growth trees, this forested watershed area that was providing water resources for the city of Portland. There was a discussion of logging it and how that would enhance water resource availability and the amount of stream flowing down. And then after they cut down the forest, they actually observed the opposite. They observed that the total amount of stream flow decreased, and so the overall water yield to the city was less desirable. And that's because those tall trees that were growing in that watershed had been basically raking the fog out of the atmosphere and causing it to drip. It was a major increase on the precipitation that was falling. So you cut down the trees and you then just have rain and snow as opposed to rain, snow, and fog drip. And if this had been done by people that were, you know, spending more time observing in that drip during the storms and had maybe hypothesized that that was a cause of the trees were a reason for the high water yields, then such a decision wouldn't have been made.
As a hydrologist, an eco-hydrologist, as you call yourself, do you run into things like this a lot where sort of the actual world tells you something quite a bit different than what your assumptions about how things should have gone actually go?
I mean, when you stumble upon one of those, that's a sweet spot for getting grant funding to pursue science. That's certainly true. So I hope to, and they come up certainly. Yeah, they come up. And when it happens, you know it. And it's like, okay, I need to jump on this. I need to pursue this. This could be important. When general conceptions conflict with what's observed.
You're in the driest state in our nation now, Nevada, albeit you're in one of the wetter parts of that state, Reno. You just arrived there from Utah, which is the second driest state in the nation, but you've also lived in Maryland and Oregon and Louisiana, in Europe. And precipitation in all of those places comes in very different ways and in very different amounts. And I suppose I'm just curious about what you've learned over your career living in these different places, just from sort of, you know, standing out in the middle of the rain.
You know, I walk around in nature through this lens of thinking about why vegetation and soils look the way they do with respect to the climate that they experience. There's so much science and research that has been done in the ecohydrology sphere. In, for example, humid, old growth and large conifer forests of the Pacific Northwest, so in Oregon. There's been a lot in the East Coast in temperate deciduous forests. But now being in the Great Basin for a few years, I'm in a constant state of awe when I'm just walking around. I don't know. There's all these patterns that I'm still trying to grapple and am excited to pursue.
That's Scott Allen. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Science at the University of Nevada at Reno. And he's one of the authors of a recent study in Nature Climate Change on global groundwater recharge changes under climate warming. Scott Allen, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you are and wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. Go donate at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.